The University of Texas presents Education Course on Computers, Freedom, and Privacy. The following presentation was recorded live in February of 1998.
For coming this morning, this is the third annual moot court that has been sponsored by the American Bar Association's Criminal Justice Section, and this time by the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center. I'd like to first thank the participants who have made this moot court possible. Although there is going to be about an hour or so of argument, the moot court has been in preparation for several months. You have an opinion that has been distributed and is on the World Wide Web. That opinion was written by two law students, Gene Page from Harvard and Kimberly Schmidt from Boston University. We also have two briefs that have been distributed. One of them has been written by Chris Kelly, formerly of Harvard. Now he's clerking for the U.S. District Court in San Diego. All right. Thank you. And by Mark Rash, who is one of our advocates, who I'll be introducing in a moment. We have a very distinguished panel of four judges, two judges from the Texas Supreme Court, which is the highest civil court in the state of Texas, one judge from the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, which is the highest criminal court in the state of Texas, and we have our old stalwart, Michael Frumkin, professor of law from the University of Miami, who was on the panel last year and who the year before was deeply involved by writing the legal opinion. I'm about to introduce bear with me, I'm having a little trouble with that light in my eye, so I'm not quite following my notes as I would like to. There are a few points I'd like to bring you into your attention. First, there's a slight change in name in the corporation. We went from Global Direct Marketing in the lower court to National Marketing, Inc. in the higher court, and I have to take responsibility for that, having changed the name with a slight miscommunication among the people who are drafting the briefs. But that happens in the real world. I mean, you know, corporations change names. I'm not sure it's on file with the Secretary of State, but we'll take care of that after the moot court is over with. We have a special note of thanks to Mark Rash, who on relatively short notice has decided to take the responsibility and shift sides. So he prepared for one side, and now he's going to be arguing the other side. So if there's anybody here who doesn't particularly agree with one of his positions, I guess the answer. And I've been asked by Bob Hamilton to point out that this is just a moot court. The people who are expressing their opinions or are expressing opinions while arguing are not necessarily expressing their own opinion. So, as he put it, please don't come chasing him down afterwards. Now, our judges are Sharon Keller of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. She received a law degree in 1978 from Southern Methodist University. From 1987 until 1994, she served as an assistant district attorney in the appellate section of the Dallas District Attorney's Office. In 1994, she was elected as the first woman to serve on the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. In addition to serving on the bench, Judge Keller is a member of the Judicial Advisory Council of the Community Assistant Division of the Texas Department of Corrections and is a member of the Supreme Court Judicial Committee on Information Technology. Justice Craig Enoch is also with us. He is a justice of the Texas Supreme Court. He received his law degree in 1975 from the Southern Methodist School of Law and holds a Master of Law degree in Judicial Process from the University of Virginia. He has been a judge since 1981, first serving in the 101st District Court in Dallas County, and then in 1987, serving as the Chief Justice for the Court of Appeals for the 5th District of Texas at Dallas. In 1993, he joined the bench of the Texas Supreme Court. He has been honored twice as an outstanding young man in America, first in 1979 and then again in 1985. Our Chief Justice today is Justice Nathan Heck, who also sits on the Texas Supreme Court. He has a Bachelor of Arts from Yale in philosophy. He received his law degree in 1974 from Southern Methodist University School of Law. Out of law school, he served as a law clerk to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. He then was a lieutenant in the United States Naval Reserve, Jack Corp. In 1981, he took the bench as a district judge in the 95th Judicial District in Dallas County. In 1986, he became a justice of the Court of Appeals for the 5th District of Texas at Dallas. And in 1988, he took the bench of the Supreme Court of Texas. Now, as far as our advocates go, we have two teams as before. They will have 30 minutes apiece to argue. They can split that time among themselves as they wish. The team representing the corporation, that is the petitioner, consists of Mark Rash, who is a veteran of this. This is I can't read my own handwriting. Representing the petitioner is going, yes, is the corporation. My apologies. I'm still going to stick with Mark. Representing the, Mark Rash. whose claim to fame among this group is prosecuting Robert Tappan Morris, who unleashed the internet virus or internet worm on the net. He served as an assistant U.S. attorney, a special assistant U.S. attorney in the District of Columbia, and as a trial attorney in the fraud section of the U.S. Department of Justice. More recently, he has been director of computer security at the SAIC Corporation. And most recently, in fact, I'm not even sure what his position is. I don't know if he knows yet. I think he's going to be general counsel, but I'm not sure, of Intelligent Solutions, Inc., another spinoff of SAIC. His partner, let me make sure I got this right, a gentleman whose name is probably not too well known in these circles, Phil Dubois. Phil represented Phil Zimmerman of PGP fame. So, of course, he's well-known to this group. This is his second appearance as an advocate in the CFP moot courts. He is currently in solo practice in Boulder, Colorado, and primarily in criminal defense work with an occasional civil case that he regrets. He has also served in the past as a state and county public defender in the state of Colorado. Now, our other team is Robert Hamilton, who is a partner in the law firm of Jones Day, Rivas & Pogue in Ohio. He has extensive experience in First Amendment and media cases, including libel, privacy, public access, copyright and trademark litigation. He has represented CompuServe in two of the early landmark decisions concerning the law of the Internet, Copy against CompuServe and CompuServe against Cyber Promotions. And finally, our last but not least advocate is Jonathan Zittrain, who is co-founder and executive director of the Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. He's also a lecturer on law at Harvard. He has served with the U.S. Department of State and the U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. For the past 14 years, he has also been a CISOP on CompuServe. He holds a bachelor's in science and cognitive science and artificial intelligence from Yale, and a law degree as well as a master in public administration from Harvard. That being said, I'd like to give you a very brief description of what the issues are in this case. You have seen the opinion. It is a spamming
question, a corporation has been distributing via the internet unsolicited advertisements on behalf of other clients. A particular state, Runnymede, has enacted a civil, not a criminal, but a civil law which restricts and effectively prohibits that practice when the transmissions arrive or affect the citizens and residents of its state. In a bench trial, the company, National Marketing Inc., was found guilty. It is challenging this on appeal. First, it appealed in the state system, and when that appeal was affirmed, or the judgment was affirmed by the state Supreme Court, there is now an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. The three issues on appeal are, first, personal jurisdiction. That is, does the state of Runnymede have the power to bring these type of cases against a company operating outside of its borders when there is no physical presence by the company within the state of Runnymede? The second is, does the Commerce Clause in the United States Constitution permit a state to impede business transactions being conducted outside of its boundaries? And the third is the First Amendment right. Is there an infringement on commercial speech that is impermissible under the U.S. Constitution? Now, Ned Ramage is in a moment going to discuss in a little bit more detail the First Amendment issue. But I want to tell you that the first two issues present in many ways a classic example of the difficulty that the Internet is posing to the legal community. That is, our Constitution is founded on the belief that we have 50 separate sovereign jurisdictions, the 50 states. They were, in fact, when they were 13, independent sovereign entities, and they bound together only because it was in their mutual interest to protect one another communally against foreign powers, most specifically Great Britain. They only very grudgingly adopted a constitution that gave central power to a chief executive and to a federal government. Clearly, as commerce has advanced and technology has advanced, the interaction among the states has become much, much greater. Initially, commerce was restricted to canals and horse and buggies and later railroads, then roads, and now commerce is being conducted instantaneously globally on the Internet. The question becomes, where does the interstate power limitations arise, and how do they affect the power of the states to regulate what is going on within their borders? With that, I'm going to turn it over to Ned Ramage, and then we will start the moot court. Thank you.
The First Amendment comes up an awful lot in CFP, and I thought one of the best ways to start out was by reading the First Amendment, because I think an awful lot of us probably don't know really what it says. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Now, one of the most popular misconceptions that I always like to bring up, and it doesn't exactly fit with this case, is that the First Amendment starts out with the word Congress, which has generally been expanded to mean government. And so it really only applies to the government. So AOL and ISPs have every right to control the content on their services, and many, many times at the First Amendment Center, people call us and say, my ISP is telling me I can't do this, or I got kicked off of AOL. But let's remember that we're talking about the government here. Now, the Supreme Court has carved out an area called commercial speech, which has traditionally gotten the lowest level of protection from the First Amendment. In 1996, there was a case called 44 Liquor Mart Incorporated versus Rhode Island, and the case involved two Rhode Island statutes that prohibited the advertising of retail prices of alcoholic beverages anywhere other than the point of sale. The court unanimously, through several different opinions, struck that statute down. But in the principal opinion, Justice Stevens wrote, "However, when the state entirely prohibits the dissemination of truthful, non-misleading commercial messages for reasons unrelated to the preservation of a fair bargaining process, there is far less reason to depart from the rigorous review that the First Amendment generally depends. Some have interpreted this as a potentially far-reaching statement that will lead to greater protection for commercial speech. Justice Clarence Thomas even went further, stating, "I do not see a philosophical or historical basis for asserting that commercial speech is of lower value than non-commercial speech. Indeed, some historical material suggests to the contrary." Well, whether or not the court moves away from the classification of commercial speech, I think it's going to be a fairly difficult task to craft a law that would actually limit spamming and still pass a constitutional muster. One of the things that the court has allowed are time, place, and manner restrictions. And in order to meet those three, I have a very hard time seeing how you could meet the three requirements in a case of spam, because place is one very difficult thing to do, as we heard with jurisdiction, and time and place. I mean, it goes on all the time, and there's no particular place involved with it. They have restricted unsolicited faxes by law. However, there are loopholes in that, which have to do with if you can prove that the person receiving the fax has given you their approval, then it's okay. It seems to me that the hardest question that is going to be before the crafters of anti-spamming legislation is to define what spam actually is. And this case today specifically deals with commercial speech. However, I imagine in the political races that we're coming up on, the midterm and then the presidential race in 2000, spam is probably going to be a very useful tool for disseminating political information. And political speech has the highest protection under the First Amendment. And so I think that that is going to be a major hurdle for trying to actually stop the dissemination of spam. Thank you.
I have one more introduction to make that I neglected, and that is Mr. David Sayre, the old timekeeper. He's the second David timekeeper. Okay, all stand. The Supreme Court of the United States is now in session. Justice Nathan Peck presiding. All ye left business before this honorable court stand now in court. God save the United States. God save
this
honorable court.
You may be seated. We have the case of Network Marketing Corporation versus the state of Runnymede on petition for writ of certiorari to the Supreme Court of the state of Runnymede. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners.
May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Zittrin, and along with Bob Hamilton, at least for the moment, we represent the petitioners in this case. Your Honors, this case involves spam. But exactly what spam is not entirely clear. The statute that we have before us offers a definition, and I would like to share that definition. This is Section 1F of the Anti-Spam Act of the State of Runnymede. Spam means an electronic communication transmitted through the use of a network or communications facility to one or more electronic addresses without the prior authorization, request, or permission of the authorized users of such electronic addresses to transmit such communications to such addresses. Now, to whatever extent that definition is clear that it is sweeping. This definition does not stop at just what we take to be bulk email, multiple emails sent indiscriminately to lots of addresses. This definition covers a single email sent by one person to another, so long as that person makes a solicitation of any kind. That solicitation could include, I'm interested in your computer. I saw that maybe you had it for sale. How much does it cost? Perhaps it could include an email that says to a law firm, do you have any spaces? I am in need of a job. These are solicitations. They are commercial or financial in nature, and they are covered by this act.
That's not what network marketing was doing in this case.
Well, network marketing has a number of clients. In fact, network marketing has never turned away a client. Our clients indeed may include some of what might be thought among experts as traditional spam, but we're happy to take non-traditional spam as well. We'll also take political spam. That includes something that says, don't you want to save the whales? Why don't you send us $5? That email is political in nature, and yet it is covered by this act. For these reasons...
Excuse me, so let me ask a question on the definition of spam. There's an organization that deals with uniform statutes across the country, Commission on Uniform Rules and Statutes. This definition, is this unusual, or is it similar to, or what is the... You talk about how broad this is. I'm interested in whether or not this is similar to statutes around the country.
Well, so far, spam suffers from the same ill that pornography does, which is to say that people are sure they know what it is, but it's only because they know it when they see it, not because there exists a given model statute that precisely lays out the contours of what it is and what it isn't. So if one were to canvass different states, there are different laws and different amounts of progress through the various legislatures and bill-making processes, and they've got all sorts of different definitions of spam.
Is it also true that, like the meat spam, nobody wants it?
Well, if nobody wanted it, it probably wouldn't last for that long, despite the fact that to send it costs very little. If absolutely nobody responded, why, there'd be no reason to send it. So it's definitely our company's view that there exist plenty of people that are delighted to have the spam. And in any event...
But the question on the broad statement of this, it would seem to me of interest to us how, if there's similar provisions in other states, how other courts have dealt with this, and whether or not there's been a usage under spam or a notion of spam that provides a practice, in fact, under this definition that's different than as you're saying it would otherwise apply.
To my knowledge, there exist no other active statutes right now in the United States specifically targeting spam. The closest there might be would be the Junk Fax Act that tries to prohibit the sending of, I don't know if I should call them junk, but unsolicited faxes that are sent to fax machines.
Is it your contention that this statute covers faxes?
No, it is not. But another interesting thing, getting back to the question of whether anybody really wants this stuff, is that there exist Supreme Court cases that say that whether or not you want it is a choice that must be left in the hands of the recipient.
But that's hard to do here.
Well, it's not hard to...
It's stuck in your box whether you want it or not.
That may be, but you could imagine a law that would insist that certain kinds of email be tagged a certain way so that an automatic email program could quite readily be programmed to toss it into the trash as soon as it arrives. But that decision to toss it into the trash, made convenient by the existence of the label, is a decision at least in the hands of the recipient. There's a case, Rowan v. United States Post Office. There's also a case called Bulger. Both of these stand together for the proposition that a sender of unsolicited communications gets at least one bite at the apple. It's not the government's place to say before the fact, before a single piece of mail has even been sent, you are not allowed to send it. And to the viewer, you are not allowed to read this, even if it's putatively for the protection of the viewer.
Now, were those commercial speech cases or political speech cases?
Well, in the case of Bulger, it had to do with condoms, and they were commercial advertisements for condoms, perhaps, but one might say that it's also information, things like that. So probably not, and it's because trying to fit something distinctly into the commercial speech category is very difficult. And actually, most of the mail that we send out, they're very long emails sometimes, and there's tons of information beyond just a solicitation. These aren't just emails that say, send us some money. They impart lots of educational materials first.
Is there any question that the emails involved in this case could be fairly be characterized as commercial speech under the Supreme Court's commercial speech jurisprudence?
My colleague will be able to speak to that at greater detail, but the answer is no. These emails are not commercial speech under Supreme Court doctrine.
State law frequently restricts hours and manner of phone solicitation. Why can't they do the same thing here?
Well, perhaps some kind of time, place, or manner restriction might be in order. And in fact, we would suggest the tagging email is one such example of a time, place, or manner restriction. But to imagine that one can't send email to people between the hours of 11 and 6, not only would that be difficult to do, but it would be hard to imagine that it would really disturb people. It's not like a ringing telephone in a house. Maybe people here, but most people don't leave their email on 24 hours a day and spring out of bed the moment the new one arrives. So for these reasons, we believe that under the First Amendment, this particular statute is wildly overbroad. It covers far more exchanges that don't represent any particular evil. I mean, for there to be a reasonable restriction on speech by the state has to come forward and say, this is the problem we're combating. And whatever those problems may be, certainly one inquiry from a job applicant to a law firm asking for if there's any interest in a job does not count as an evil that the state has any business combating. Despite that fact, this statute covers it.
Well, but that law student never used network marketing to get that message there.
Well, network marketing certainly wouldn't turn away that student's business.
Right. We're beginning to gather that.
Indeed. And in fact, network marketing offers some software that allows people who use the Internet to facilitate their job searches, for example, by being able to canvass a number of law firms simultaneously, asking if there is interest in their being an applicant. Again, we would say that this is protected activity of an individual under the First Amendment and not properly banned by this statute.
You said in your brief, and you said earlier, that by its term, the statute precludes web-based advertising in a broad sense. Did the lower court address that specifically, or did you make that argument in the lower court?
Whether it covers web-based advertising?
A broader category of advertising than email. I mean, than what your company does. You said that term precludes web-based advertising, which, like advertising on Yahoo or other search engines, causes ads to appear on the user screen without the user's request for that information.
We're happy to say that this act is so wildly unconstitutional that we need not rely on the statute covering web-based advertising. And I apologize for any suggestion in our brief that this act actually covers that. This act is meant to cover email. We'll concede that.
Okay.
Now, of course, there are two other reasons why the state of Runnymede has no business passing this statute. That has to do with personal jurisdiction and the Commerce Clause. With respect to personal jurisdiction, we have a real problem here. All we've done is send email out into the ether. And it was a fact found below by the court. The court gave this credence and found it as a fact that we have absolutely no way of knowing where our email was going to go.
Well, you say that, but you're hoping it goes to the state of Running.
Well, we would like it to be somewhat pervasive, that's true.
You don't go to your customers and say, well, we don't know whether this is going to reach anybody or not. You tell them it's going to reach everyone.
That may be, but in order for an ought to be applied to us, we ought to do this, it must be so that we can do it. To impose a requirement on us that says, don't send email to anybody in Runnymede, it must be that we are able to do that. And the only way we're able to do that is not to send any email at all. This results in a total ban for us on any email. And in fact, at this very moment, our company is under an injunction, which if we send a single unsolicited piece of email that happens to end up in Runnymede, all of our corporate assets, and I must say they are substantial, can be seized by this state. And that has been referred to in the briefs and in the opinion below as the corporate death penalty. And I must say, while some people may find spam annoying, there must be some sense of proportionality to the penalty meted out in the event of a violation. But indeed, this, because we cannot know where this email is going to go, essentially amounts to a total ban for us and for everybody else on any kind of unsolicited email. This also touches on our Commerce Clause problem. Essentially, the state of Runnymede has managed to make a law that everybody in the United States must follow at their own peril.
With respect to jurisdiction, though, where can you be sued?
Where can we be sued?
Yes.
Well, we can certainly be sued where we are.
Which is?
We happen to be in some hypothetical land.
Why wouldn't, since you can do this electronically, why wouldn't you move that hypothetical base as far away from civilization as you could?
We plan to, Your Honor.
Virtually.
There was a session yesterday on vigilante justice, and we're well aware, too, of more than just the threat of jurisdiction by the state.
Texas is known for vigilante.
Indeed it is. But the fact is we have to be somewhere, and that somewhere is going to have laws that govern our behavior. Now, to be sure, we may pick the place that will have the kindest possible laws for our kind of activities.
Well, not only that, but the furthest place away from any other likely litigant. I mean, who wants to go to the furthest reaches of the country to litigate the influx of spam?
Now, that's true, and that actually raises an interesting point, although recognize here that the litigant in this statute is the Attorney General of the state of Runnymede, who may well appreciate a trip to the Grand Caymans. This is not an individual who receives spam and then, with penniless and just totally blindsided by the spam, apparently not so penniless to have an email account, then has to go out and find us and sue us. This is the Attorney General of the state of Runnymede, and to plead that Runnymede has no way of bringing its case somewhere else really doesn't get it.
Isn't it your contention that, in fact, Runnymede has no way to regulate this act?
Runnymede has a way to regulate it, but not in the way it has chosen. One way it might choose to regulate it would be through its elected representatives in the United States Congress. Let them put on the pressure that's necessary. If this is truly such an evil, no doubt Congress will see the wisdom of the argument and pass a federal law on the issue.
If we were to accept your argument about personal jurisdiction, wouldn't, if this was a foreign source,
yes,
wouldn't the United States also lack personal jurisdiction?
Not necessarily. It's true that the United States, in its own jurisprudence, doesn't like the thought of having to extend its laws extraterritorially. But it's not merely just a regression from a state not liking to have its laws apply outside state boundaries. States are still states, and the United States is still a country. And the policy factors that might well go into the United States choosing to have an anti-spam law, and as a matter of foreign policy, have to deal with off-site spammers, is a far different calculus than a single state taking it upon itself to regulate the other 49 states.
Well, let me ask you, your argument strikes me a little bit about I shot an arrow into the air, I know not, it came to earth, I know not where. It seems to be you're arguing that you should be free to shoot your arrows wherever you should be free from any responsibility from where your arrows land because you don't know where they're going when you shoot them. Well, it seems to me that the state does have a legitimate interest in protecting its citizens from these indiscriminate arrows without saying this has to have a national solution.
There's no doubt about it. The fact is that on the internet currently, and it's just currently, there's no easy way to know where this stuff is going to go. So the internet by its nature is going to have these so-called indiscriminate arrows. That's a fact. And given that fact, you have to make a choice. You have to choose between one state law that by regulating purportedly only stuff going into its own state will end up inevitably regulating the entire internet, or it's true, no state regulation at all. And we say that the latter choice is the better one. And it doesn't mean no regulation at all. Surely there could be, again, a federal law that would speak to this issue. This is precisely the kind of interstate, unpredictable commerce that knows no boundary at the state line that was designed for federal or even global regulation. We're certainly not averse to the UN convening a commission on this subject.
This takes us to Pataki. And I just want—I know your time is running out. I just want to assume with me that we decide to follow Pataki and tell us what are the standards that that imposes on us if we follow Pataki and how that helps your client's case.
Well, of course, the suit you're referring to, Your Honor, ALA versus Pataki, it was dealing with a website, really, that was out of New York State, and that website was thought to conflict with some particular New York State law, and New York residents could readily visit the site. And in that case, the holding was that New York is essentially regulating conduct that's wholly outside the state's borders. It's also regulating conduct in the state's borders, but much of that regulation falls outside of the state's borders. And that's exactly what's happening here. So the fact that it's a website versus email is not a distinction that really matters here. I see my time is up.
Thank you.
I thank the court.
May it please the court, Mark Rash for the state of Runnymede, the respondent in this case. What we have here is the pernicious evil of spam, as the Chief Justice has observed, with the question of whether or not anybody wants spam. The answer is, by definition, no one wants spam. Spam is defined in the statute as unsolicited, or in this case, unwanted, electronic mail messages or electronic communications. So by its definition, spam is unwanted. Now, none of the types of communications that Mr. Zittrain mentioned would have been prohibited by the Runnymede statute. Individual solicitations like that are not the types of things that are intended to be or are in fact covered by the statute. The statute is as specific as it can be. And as with obscenity and pornography, well, obscenity at least, one of the problems with spam is that it is not capable of a specific definition. But if we look at the purposes behind the statute, which is the protection of the citizens and residents of the state of Runnymede against the improper cost-shifting nature of spam, much as in the anti-junk fact statutes, the problem with spam is not based on its content. The problem with spam is based on its volume.
Let me stop you right there. You mentioned the fact statute, but that's a federal statute, and this is a state statute. So let me put you the question I put to Mr. Zittrain. If we follow the Pataki case, what does that direct us to do on these facts?
Well, first of all, there are now 20 different states that also have state junk facts statutes. So the fact that the federal government has, in fact, passed a junk facts statute does not preclude the state from doing the same. So even if you follow Pataki, there's no need to strike down an individual state regulation as in this case. Now, Pataki basically holds that the principle is that if the federal government or if the type of regulation must by its nature be national, or for example, if the individual state regulation will put an impermissible burden on interstate commerce such that there must be some national legislation, then the state has to demonstrate that there is a compelling need for it to act.
Well, Mr. Zittrain suggests that this closes him down. That seems like a fairly weighty burden. Why isn't that an impermissible burden?
Well, it doesn't close him down. First of all, at worst, assuming that no one agrees that they want to receive any of this spam, which Mr. Zittrain would say wasn't true because he says there are plenty of people who want this. If plenty of people want it, a simple method could be devised for getting them to agree to it. It doesn't close them down. It means they cannot send electronic mail targeted at individuals within the state of Runnymede.
Can they send it to a .com address where they can't tell what the location is? Are you conceding that?
If they send it to a specific .com address without an IP address, without knowledge of where the IP address is?
Supposing they send it to hundreds of people at AOL.com, and they're not aware of their location.
Then they proceed at their own peril in doing so. Just as if they were to send libelous mailings to people, if we take it out of the spam and put it into libel, defamation, or any of the traditional areas that states traditionally regulate, then by sending out a libelous, a slanderous, a defamatory message, a copyright violation, a trademark violation, they deliberately invoke the jurisdiction of the state where it's received, where the harm occurs. And in those kinds of situations, they cannot defend by saying, well, again, as Justice Enoch said, I shot an arrow in the air where it landed, I know not where. And they can't simply say, well, I didn't care where it went. So they send it with reckless disregard or with knowledge that it's going into the state of Runnymede. Then they very well subject themselves to the jurisdiction of the state of Runnymede. There's also another question on personal jurisdiction, and that is, if not here, then where? Because if we reject the concept that the state of Runnymede has the right to protect its citizens against the unsolicited, unwanted, and harmful and costly electronic mail messages, then we say that no state may do so.
I'd like to take you back for a moment to the Dormant Commerce Clause, because I'm still a little puzzled here. And the basic underlying principle of the Dormant Commerce Clause is that, by and large, one state should not be able to make a rule which has national effects and effectively binds conduct in all other states. Now, is it your argument that if we were to find that this was a statute that violated that principle, that logic would compel us to overturn the libel laws of this state?
The libel laws, to the extent that the libel laws have the same effect, then yes. Because if the libel laws of the state of Runnymede then preclude somebody from sending a libelous or defamatory statement across the internet when applied to this technology, and you say, well, I could say it in New York, but I can't say it in Runnymede, therefore I can't send it out on the internet. I think Runnymede still has a legitimate interest in enforcing its libel laws to communications which are sent to Runnymede.
But you agree the effect of that could not be felt in the state of New York, for example.
The effect could be felt in the state of New York if a person from New York sent a communication to Runnymede.
Well, I understand, but if for example, coming back more specifically, the people of New York actually want spam, unlikely as that seems,
right.
The state of Runnymede can't, by its own laws, prohibit spam from being sent into New York.
That's correct, and nor does it do so.
They argue that it does.
Well, they argue that as an effect. Because they do not know or choose not to know where the spam is going, they must adopt essentially a least common denominator, and that says send no spam at all.
But
that simply isn't the case.
The lower court found that they could only send it indiscriminately or not at all.
Well, this may be true, but they cannot target Runnymede. They cannot send it deliberately to Runnymede. And there's a big difference between the facts of Pataki and the facts here. When I put out a website, for example, as in the case of Pataki, I have no control at all who may see it, both in the nation and internationally. Right? When I send email to an address, I do have the ability, at least, I don't have the absolute ability, but I have the ability to know who I'm sending it to in most cases. It's not absolute. For example, if I were to dial a telephone number in Austin, Texas, I don't necessarily know that I'm reaching an individual who is physically located in Austin, Texas. They could have call forwarding on. They could be anywhere in the country or in the world. But I know that I have targeted people within Austin, Texas. A classic example of this would be state regulation of lotteries. Every state has a regulation which applies to lotteries. If I'm in the business of conducting lotteries, it is my obligation to learn what the state laws are in each state, which states prohibit lotteries, which states permit lotteries, and to comply with the laws of each state. Now, this defendant in this case, the petitioner, is in the business of sending out unsolicited electronic mail messages. This is their business. They derive revenues from their activities within the state of Runnymede. And their harm is felt directly by the citizens of Runnymede. The state of Runnymede has a legitimate interest in regulating this type of activity. That regulation has only an incidental effect on wholly extra state activities. For example, nothing here would stop the petitioner from New York, say, or from Hiawatha, sending email messages to people they know to be in New York, they know to be in New Jersey, they know to be in California. It only precludes them from sending to people they know to be in Runnymede.
This remains troublesome because surely you wouldn't say that Runnymede could stop 18-wheelers at the border just because it didn't like big trucks in the state.
Well,
that would be a direct impingement on interstate commerce. How is this any different?
In such a case, they could if they had a compelling state interest, for example.
How could you stop interstate commerce at your border just because you didn't like 18-wheelers? And wouldn't that favor local commerce, which is exactly what the Commerce Clause is directly against?
Well, let's look at that. Let's assume that the state of Runnymede had no interstate highways, and they had no ability to handle 18-wheelers. 18-wheelers would destroy their roads and the like. In such a case, there may be a compelling state interest. I doubt very much that the court or Congress would permit that to happen. But that would have a direct effect on interstate commerce. In this case, the effect is only incidental.
Is the distinction you're offering between 18-wheelers that were delivering in state, sort of coming to rest in the state, and those going through and hear the messages come to rest in the state, is that significant for Commerce Clause purposes?
Well, the answer there is not that the petitioner is arguing essentially, regardless of where it comes to rest, it has an effect on wholly extra-state activities. And so the same argument there is made. Even in this case, it's irrelevant where it comes to rest for the petitioner's argument. For our purposes, the fact is that they are going directly and deliberately into the state of Runnymede and therefore are subject to the jurisdiction, both under personal jurisdiction grounds and under dormant commerce clause grounds.
How is this different from the state of Runnymede trying to prohibit the broadcasting of particular commercials in the state, into the state, such as tobacco advertisements or liquor advertisements?
Well, in the case of the communications media like that, Congress has in fact occupied the field. And in that type of situation, if Congress had acted and had stated in this particular case, we will regulate all Internet activities, even then such a statute as the Runnymede Anti-Spam Act might still be constitutional, just as prohibiting regulating of Internet as a means doesn't mean that the state can't have, for example, a defamation or libel lawsuit based on the content that's sent into the area. So the fact that Congress has regulated in the field does not necessarily preclude the state from regulating as well. For example, if there were an anti-fraud statute within the state of Runnymede that said you can't make these types of solicitations or these types of commercial communications.
This is the end of side one. Please turn the tape over to continue.